Today's program is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. For more information, visit mofad.org.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Christina Gill of an amazing book, Tasting Rome. But even more amazing is your life and career. I got the longest in-depth bio email from you when I said, I want to know a little bit more about you, where you came from, why you're interested in food, in photography. And I don't know how many paragraphs it was, but it was like the length of an intro to this cookbook. It was really fascinating because I've known your work and your career for quite some time through Design Sponge in the Kitchen with Grace Bonney, and I've admired your work, and this is the whole package right here. You not only get to photograph, but you get to profess your love of Roman cuisine.
Yeah, it was the introduction, or to answer the questions in your email. I confess I was in the airport, so I had a lot of time to kill. But yeah, I was really happy with the book because it does kind of combine everything. It's the recipe, the development of the recipes, and then the photography, and it was really, really fun.
Yeah, you were just telling me that this project kind of morphed. It changed. The proposal kind of took shape eventually, but it initially started because of cab rides.
Yeah, so for work, my regular job is a humanitarian food assistance advisor. I have to go to meetings, which are about an hour away from my office, and well, it's an hour there and an hour back, so I spent a lot of time in cabs, and I'm always really curious to talk to people, and I thought, well, what can I do to test whether or not it's true that Romans only eat their mother's cooking, for example, or their own city's cuisine? So I just started talking to cab drivers about recipes, and over the course of 2 years or so, they gave me over 100 recipes. And I was sitting there looking at it and thought this would make a really... Well, to me, I thought it would be an interesting cookbook. It wasn't interesting to the first person I pitched it to. And then I broadened it to a Rome cookbook, and still it wasn't the right timing for Rome. People said, no, Rome isn't interesting. Rome books don't sell. And so I waited 4 years, and in that time I met Katie, and we kind of got together and made it what it is today. And then it was just the right minute at the right time and the right place, sorry, for the book to take off.
Yeah. So you talk about these cab drivers. If you did this project in New York and asked those same people what they cooked at home or what they ate, it's so multi-ethnic here. Did you find that there were, you know, generational natives in Rome?
The majority of the cab drivers in Rome are Roman, and that is why it was a good survey, because you don't have many professions like that in Rome where the people are, you know, Roman, born and raised. Some of the cab drivers in Rome are from Abruzzo nearby, and they came in the 50s, so they've been in Rome for 60 years, long enough to really have adapted their palate to Roman cooking. And that's basically it. So I don't think I got any non-Roman. I may have gotten one non-Roman cab driver, was a very, 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 I shouldn't call him very, very old. He was in his 70s, from Turin.
Yeah.
And that was it. But everyone else was either from Rome or Abruzzo.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the definition, I think, of Cucina Romana is migrant. I mean, there were a lot of people that came from the poorer south, moving north and kind of established that city's cuisine over time. What established your cuisine for you? I know you're a southern girl.
Yes. Yeah. Very southern.
Yeah. And you had gardens on one side, rice-a-roni, shake and bake.
Yes,
you know,
I did.
Pillsbury biscuits on the other.
Best of the 70s cuisine, goober and iceberg lettuce.
What is goober?
It's the jar. I think it might be by Smucker's. It's the jar that has the peanut butter and the grape
already
jelly.
Mixed.
Yeah, all in the spiral in the jar.
Yeah, what efficiency.
I wasn't, because my older brother, I guess maybe as long as I can remember, maybe until he moved out of the house, all he would eat was peanut butter and jelly. That's it.
Yeah.
He would eat nothing else. Breakfast, peanut butter and jelly. Lunch, peanut butter and jelly. Dinner, peanut butter and jelly.
I guess having it all in one jar conserves space.
We didn't eat that much goober, but sometimes we did have goober. It's not very good.
Yeah.
So,
but most of your family's cooking, or at least your father's, came from the backs of boxes and cans.
My poor father. Yes.
We're not ragging on him too much, but
he did his best. He did come, you know, his favorite from the canned salmon was these salmon patties. And he was really enthusiastic about that. I think maybe there was like a Velveeta cheese box that had some sort of ground beef casserole that he made with, you know, green peppers, bell peppers and stuff in it. But I guess I didn't really start my own cooking. Oh, and I also told you about my grandmother in the summers where we had to go gather fruit in the backyard. It was indentured slavery, I guess you could say. the preserves that were made were good. But I didn't really start my own cooking until my last year at school. And I didn't have eggplant until my first year of graduate school when I was in Bologna. So, you know, I was already like 22 before I'd ever had eggplant. So it's
interesting. It's fascinating to have a new fruit or vegetable in your life this day and age, because we get exposed to so much. But you went to Stanford not for a culinary degree at all.
No. I don't even know if they offer that. I mean, you know, things have changed since then. I don't want to date myself, but they might offer it now, but probably not.
What did you study going to college and then parlay into going to Florence?
I studied political science, and the study abroad is really just a general, I think you could do art history, political science with a European focus. In the Stanford and Florence Center, and I did a year of that, one quarter in one year and two quarters in another year, so sophomore and junior year. And then I went to graduate school at Johns Hopkins SAIS, so I did a year in Bologna, which was, you know, different cooking even then. So I had a family in Florence. The first family I stayed with, she really loved Thailand, oddly enough, and I only ate Thai food when I stayed in Florence. And then when I moved to another family, they were Tuscan, and she grew up in a rural family. And so it was, her mother would give her the chicken from the farm, the chicken broth, which is really fatty chicken broth, which is the best chicken broth ever. And she was the best cook I've ever known. So I did, you know, learn a lot from her. And then in Bologna, I stayed with a family there and learned some from them and from other friends in Padova and around.
Yeah. It seems fascinating because bookended between these two study abroads, you also started collecting cookbooks.
I did.
And educating yourself,
you
know, through that literature. So what were the cookbooks that you first bought, and what were those recipes you first cooked?
I think the first book I really got into was Flatbreads and Flavors. And then I had an African cookbook because I wanted some Ethiopian food. And I got Flow Breakers, The Art of Baking. And I think those may have been like the first ones I had. And then when I went that summer, I went to, I was doing an internship at the State Department, and I was in a little gourmet food store, and I met a guy there whose name was Phil Furstenberg. And for some reason, I'm not exactly sure why, he's one of the nicest people I ever met. We were talking about baking, and he's like, I'm going to bring you something. And a couple days later, I went back, and he gave me Carol Field's The Italian Baker book. And his father, it turned out, I didn't know what Marvelous Market was then, but his father had learned to bake, and he did a lot of time working with Carol Field, and he started Marvelous Market in Washington, D.C., which people in that time, I'm dating myself again, will know the significance of Marvelous Market, and he has since sold it. But then I was really into baking, and so I bought all of Carol Field's book, focaccia. I'm not sure what it's called, like an antipasti type book. And so I really started baking bread, and then I, you know, got the Nancy Silverton book, and I did my whole starter. And you know, everyone who's started a starter knows what that's like. And all my friends thought I was crazy traveling on the train with my little starter thing. I was like, I gotta feed the starter.
Oh, it's like a pet. Yeah, it's a living, breathing thing.
And I was making everything that I ate from scratch. So that was fun. I remember one time I burned some loaves of bread because I fell asleep and they stayed in the oven, and I had them stacked in a bag outside of the front door. My friend thought I'd put my shoes in a bag outside the front door. That's when I started doing all the baking, and I had all the baking tools for that. I got my stand mixer then. I was just crazy cooking and really enjoying it. And then I got a job where I didn't have time anymore. So
yeah,
I stopped.
Well, I mean, eventually you stopped that job to pursue what you're doing today is the anthropological study of food and culture. And what's awesome is you bypassed the Food Network revolution.
I did.
You were overseas. So you're almost an autodidact in the sense that you taught yourself, not only how to cook, but how to learn about cooking.
Yeah. I think maybe on the very front end. So, I mean, this was something that I wrote to you about when I left the United States in 1999. Great Chefs, Great Cities was on. HGTV had just started. And I remember being really mad because I couldn't get it in my cable package. And there were no real TV celebrities back then. And they were cookbook celebrities. So you're really into the cookbooks. Baking with Julia came out then. Marcel Desaulniers was doing his Death by Chocolate and Death by Chocolate Cake, I think. I have all of his books, too. Nancy Silverton, Rose Levy-Barenbaum, Lisa Yokelson, who was doing a column, I think, in the Washington Post also. But, you know, I looked forward every week to the food column in the Washington Post and joined the Cookbook of the Month Club and got the books and really just worked through them and just had a really good time.
Yeah. I mean, working in these, embassies, these political and foreign affairs, did you position yourself saying, I want to go to Italy because I want to work in this field or because I want to learn more about Italian cuisine?
It was actually neither. I think sad as it may be, it's a practical decision. When you go into the Foreign Service, they will only give you a limited amount of language training. And if you already have languages, they don't have to invest that money in you, because when you have to have the language training, you're offline, but they still need work done. So somebody else is doing the work. And I already had the Italian when I came in. So I tested at the highest level for a non-native speaker. So they were able to send me out. So it was not quite a choice as food as much as, hey, I'm going to go live in Italy for 3 years.
And yeah,
then I picked back up with the food.
Yeah. I mean, did you feel like you had a predisposition for the cuisine, though, having baked or maybe having had something in your past that felt like Italian food?
Yeah, because I was only away after graduate school. Like, maybe I was only away for like 2 years. So it was much like a continuation of being able to pick back up on, you know, cooking pasta or making pasta or making pizza or things like that, pizza dough, things like that.
So when you decided to leave that behind and kind of venture forth in you know, these food studies, how did you make that transition, and what did you start doing? Did you start your cab interviews at that time?
No, it came much later. So I got a different job. I did some communications work for a bit, and then I got a different job in something that's actually the exact opposite of the type of food you and I do. The humanitarian assistance side is, you know, dealing with the bottom 10% poorest people in the world and managing a portfolio that ensures that my employer's money gets to the right people when they need it in response to an emergency crisis. So you would have had Tropical Storm Winston just now in Fiji. When you had the earthquake in Nepal, you have these things going on, DRC, Chad, and we're sending humanitarian assistance there. So that's the sad side of food. It's also the realistic side of food. And then at the same time, for fun, I was on the fun side of food, which is the design sponge part and making cakes and things like that.
Yeah.
It was fun, yeah.
Well, I mean, I also think it's fascinating that largely embedded within Roman cuisine is cucina povera, which is the food of the poor. So, I mean, you got to see that internationally through this, in a sense, disaster relief.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I wouldn't really put them in the same category because I think it's almost, this is going to be a pretty heavy way to say it, but I also think it's kind of, you have to be really careful talking about, you know, we're sitting here at Roberta's in a first world country with this luxury food and putting it together with those type of poor people who oftentimes, if they don't have assistance from World Food Program, they just don't eat.
Yeah.
So I really do keep it separately, but it also makes me appreciate much more being able to work with food and have that, what I consider a luxury to work with food and to choose what to eat and when to eat it.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, come back and talk about In the Kitchen With, which is kind of the amazing juncture where you got to do exactly that. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Peter Kim, the Executive Director of MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. We're a nonprofit founded by Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues here on the Heritage Radio Network, and we want to take people on a learning adventure through the world of food. We just opened MOFAD Lab, our gallery space at 62 Bayard Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where we are currently showing Flavor, Making It and Faking It. Flavor features some very cool sensory interaction. Flavor tablets deliver tastings of vanilla and umami. And the Willy Wonka-inspired smell synth lets you compose over 500,000 different flavors. So come on by and visit MOFAD Lab. We're open 5 days a week, and tickets are $5 for kids and $10 for adults. Learn more about the Museum of Food and Drink at MOFAD.org.
Hey, and welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. See, I screwed up my own name. with Christina Gill of Tasting Room. In the Kitchen With, which I've been lucky enough to at least be a part of once or twice. My memory fails me.
Grilled pizza.
Yeah, that's what it was. The preserved lemon jalapeno smoked mozz was one of my favorite things about Design Sponge. And there are a lot. You know, I love Grace and we miss her dearly on the station. But I obsessively, maybe like you did for WAPO and those cookbook clubs, waited for the next edition of In the Kitchen With to come out. How did that project start, and how lucky did you feel being able to talk to those people and get those recipes?
It came about because Grace and I were, virtual pen pals. We were friends online, as happens today. There are a lot of really good work relationships created online. And I was just coming up with ideas. I mean, not affiliated with the site at all in any way, and just said, hey, how come or why don't you have a column that has the recipes of your favorite creative professionals? And she said, that's a great idea. Why don't you do it? And I started to do it. And it's evolved a lot since then. In the beginning, you know, we had Camilla Engman. Lena Corwin has been on several times. And people were doing their own drawings and own photography, and it was really personal in that sense. And when we had to transition to kind of keep the content and the visuals the same across the site, then I had to start learning more about photography, and I had to learn to shoot it myself. And so that's how the photography side of it started.
Yeah. Luckily, there was this guy named Matt Bites at the time.
Yeah. Matt and I had already been friends, or I had made friends with Matt, and he's like, okay, why don't you come out to my studio and I'll help you. So I flew out to Long Beach 2 years in a row. And we worked through things in the studio, and I absorbed a lot, and I kept working. And, you know, even to this day, if I get stuck on something, he will send me a diagram and say, okay, light it this way, or, you know, put your scrim here, or flags here. And so he's still very, very present in my life. I mean, he's my best friend.
Yeah. So, I mean, all this gave you a template for Tasting Room in a way that I don't feel like... You know, so many people are unprepared doing their first cookbook, and you were just wholly prepared for this thing.
Very much.
So ready. How did you start, and who did you go to? Because what's amazing is it's not only recipes about Roman food, it is the best people making that Roman cuisine at the time. It's contemporary.
Yeah, so for Tasting Rome, obviously I had a visual idea of what I wanted, because a lot of that was from those cab rides across Rome, where I go through the center of Rome and then get out to the periphery, which I consider, you know, the real Rome, not the beautiful postcard images, but, you know, really where most Romans live. And I wanted something that was kind of gritty in the photography, and in the food. I think, you know, once someone has a style of photography, that's what it is. So the food is shot in my style. But for the recipes, it actually worked really good, very complimentary, because I developed recipes. You know, I did half of that and developed the recipes. And Katie has a really, really strong knowledge of all of the restaurant owners and people doing the food. And so she was able to get recipes from these people for her half of the book. And, you know, she is out eating and she knows where the best exemplars are of carbonara, gricia, cacio e pepe. So she knew exactly where to go to get those recipes.
Isn't that all Roscioli?
Katie has very clear views on that.
Yeah.
What the best dish is in each category. And I think the Roscioli is the matriciana in the book.
Yeah.
And that's the one that she wanted in the book, and so we've got that there.
It's so funny, those four pastas that we just mentioned are such slight iterations of each other, but they're so distinctly different.
Yeah, very different. So your carbonara has egg, but your gricia doesn't, and the cacio e pepe she has there. And you know, this is a defect of mine, I really think you need three arms to do the cacio e pepe to really do it right.
Yeah.
You know, to keep the spoon going, to get everything creamy. But people have been having a lot of success with the recipe, so.
Yeah. No, I'm certainly making cacio e pepe is one of my favorite. And we have the cacio e pepe and carbonara revolution, where it finds itself outside of just that pasta dish. Mm. You know, people are cacio e pepe-ing things.
Yes, everything. Yeah. The souffle, which we have in the book. Sandwiches. They have something on the menu here I thought was a cacio e pepe,
yeah,
but it wasn't under the pizza column.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah. I can't remember what it was.
You know, it was really interesting. The souffle, which I think is one of the first recipes in the book, is in a sense a rice croquetta. Mm. You know, and I didn't realize how little rice is in Roman cuisine.
Yeah, there's almost no rice.
Yeah.
Like almost none. And I always tell people who come to Rome and they look at on a menu and they're like, I want a risotto. And I'm like, okay, Rome is not the place to eat that.
Yeah.
So focus on something else.
So what are the things to eat in Rome? What are those exemplars?
Obviously your holy, if it's not a trinity, what is it? If it's four, what is it? A holy, I don't know how you say four.
Quattro, I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Those four pasta
quartet
dishes.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you like offal, which I call it awful.
I'll make you change that.
Yes, yeah. Well. Awful, you should really taste that. Pizza is a good thing to try, because, you know, of the difference between Roman pizza and Neapolitan pizza, and that is another topic that's very near and dear to Katie's heart.
Yeah.
So you'll find her talking a lot about the differences in pizzas. I think just a lot of, I'm a big fan of just tasting around when you go to new places and new cuisines, tasting new things. So I would definitely say those pasta dishes, some pizza dishes, gelato, you know, maybe some of the local wines from the area, because those are things that each place you go has different wine.
Yeah. what I love is that there are newer iterations of very classic dishes in here. And one of my favorites is mozzarella and carozza. And you have Gabriele Bianchi blew that up and made an nduja and carozza, which
yes.
sounds like the greatest grilled cheese of all time.
It is. It is. So after I did all the fried stuff in the book, I strategically put my fryer at a friend's house, and I left it, and I have not picked it up
yeah.
in a year because I don't want to fry it. But that mozzarella and nduja is, you know, it's two slices of mozzarella with the smear of nduja in between the slices.
Which is a Calabrian spreadable yeah, salami.
Spicy. Yeah. And you can put as little or as much. I recommend a lot. And then it's deep fried, and it is so, so good. Good. And I almost, in developing and testing, would mess it up on purpose, so I'd have to do another batch so I could eat more.
Yeah, yeah. You know, on the cover of this book, there are those fried, squash blossoms, which I, for one, have never been in love with. But just looking at this and reading this head note, I'm more than willing to give another chance. And why is that the cover? Why is that emblematic of Rome?
The publisher, Aaron, had a very, very clear idea in his head what he wanted for the cover. And, you know, sometimes people have different, you know, you try to get to a solution. Are we going to do a line drawing? Are we going to do this? What sums up Rome? And that was it. It was either the fried ones or pan-fried with mozzarella inside. And actually, they almost chose the pan-fried with mozzarella image. And I did a behind the scenes on Design Sponge where I show the other image. But that's what he wanted.
Yeah.
And I think it came out really great.
Oh, it's stunning. And again, having been to Rome a few times, this feels like Rome right here.
Yeah.
from the palate to, you can almost smell that too. You know, Rome has this distinct odor, is the wrong word. I mean, in certain areas, maybe the Colosseum, that's special, but it has this, it emanates of these beautifully fried fresh things, which I always found fascinating, because you're taking the greatest like spring blossoms off of the squash and then frying them to only, you know, amplify their flavor.
Or putting them on pizza. It's a very delicate flavor.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting that you say about the odors in a positive sense, because one of my favorite things to do is to walk through, you know, narrow streets or in residential neighborhoods around lunchtime, mid-morning, 10 o'clock, because you can still smell the preparation for the lunch, and you can smell, you know, what the sofrito that the people are doing. And, you know, my husband and I will walk around and we'll smell and say, oh, it smells like they're having, you know, roast chicken for dinner or for lunch, or today they're having peas and veal for lunch, because you can smell the odors.
Yeah.
And it's really, our dream is to just knock on somebody's door and say, can we come up for lunch?
Yeah. No, have you not done that yet?
I feel
like that's your next book.
Okay, I did do that, and I did that with this old man in a park when I was shooting for the book. And he said, okay, let me call my wife, and I'll bring you over. And my husband pulled me back, and he was like, you cannot go over to a stranger's house for lunch. And I was like, why not? He just invited me.
Yeah.
So I didn't get to go.
No, I feel like Rome may seem closed door when you're walking through these things, because you don't see a lot of people on the street during lunchtime because they're in eating with their family. I think they'd be so welcoming.
I'm going to try that the next time I go. And when I do, I will let you know about it.
Yeah. I mean, my people, the Jewish quarters, I feel like I can get away with walking in there a little bit easier. But again, with that smell in the air, what I love about that area is all the vinegar. You know I'm a vinegar nut.
Yeah.
But a lot of the things, a lot of the fish have strong vinegar to them. Or what is the dish you have in the book with
the concha?
Yeah, with the
that's fried and
fried
then,
marinated zucchini.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you smell this like a kind of sweet and sour in the air in that area, which is just, it's bewilderingly amazing.
Yeah. That is a really good dish to put on a sandwich, for example. And I think maybe, I can't remember, but I think Katie does recommend that on that recipe to try it out as a sandwich.
Yeah. Well, porchetta obviously can be had on its own, but it's I feel like a very emblematic sandwich of Rome itself.
Very much so, because the Ariccia, the area right outside of Rome, is, you hear the Porchetta di Ariccia, and that's really where it comes from, the Rome, I guess the Castelli area. We have the recipe for Vito Bernabei in there to make the roast pork at home. And I can tell you, because we made the roast pork, it is so good, and you should have seen us in the studio really picking over all, especially the crispy bits.
Yeah,
it's really good.
You know, what's perfect for this time is the artichokes, peas, fava. How do you say that term?
The vignarola.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful thing just on its own. It's a stew of spring vegetables,
yep.
But as pasta, I can...
Exactly.
It's just an amazing, amazing thing that I feel like signifies not only this birth of spring cuisine, but it really feels like Rome at its core.
It is, and it's funny because when we did that recipe in the studio, I'm a big advocate of peeling your fava beans twice so we could keep it really brilliant green, and Adam Pearson, the food stylist, said, okay, yes, and then you boil your salad as you do, and he came home the next day, he said, that was the absolute best pasta condiment I have ever had in my life. So I think if people do try it, make a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And have leftover for pasta, and it's really good.
Yeah, I know. It's funny going to the green market and picking over these things and like, oh, I can, they're very temporal, I'm going to serve them tonight. No, this is something that you want to stow away and have spring all year round.
Yeah.
Another amazing recipe is Brutta ma Buoni.
The little cookies.
But again, another thing I think that exemplifies Roman cuisine is this term, ugly but delicious. Because sometimes you see these shapes, sometimes you see these colors, and it's just this kind of mishmash of things that blows your mind how distinctly different everything tastes and the flavor combinations. And these little cookies, you know, at the end of a meal, still carry that sense of, you know, everything it's at its peak, everything is its best, and everything is just beautiful as it is.
I like the cookies because they are really, we did them with hazelnuts, they're just really good flavor explosions. And I actually personally don't think they're particularly ugly, but that's the name for a lot of cookies that don't have a particular form or shape.
Yeah.
And I really do. I like those cookies as well. I mean, I know I sound like I'm biased. There are some things like tripe that I'm not a big fan of. But generally, I can say 90%, 99%, except for the tripe in the book, I don't like tripe, yeah. Is really good.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that because I'm biased. I just really had a good time eating the food in the book.
Guanciale, we'll end with this. Is it better than bacon?
It has its place. So
very judicious of you.
it has its place. I think they're all from the same family, and you know, pork is pork, and when it's crispy, when it's good, it's good.
But Azienda Agricola Finelli, they make the best one.
The guanciale, yes, that is Katie's A+ for them. Yes.
Yeah. So if someone wants to go to Rome, and Christina's not available to take you around to other people's houses to eat lunch, this is the book to get. It is such a wonderful map of not only where to go, but how to understand what you're having. You must be very proud.
I am very proud, and we've had a lot of good response. And yeah, I think that the publisher did a really great job of putting the photos together in the book and just made it really unique for a lot of the books that are out right now in spring. It's got a unique layout, and I am super proud and really, really, really happy.
Yeah, so Rome wasn't built in a day, and please, just don't go to Rome for 24 hours and eat. You need to spend a lifetime there. So get Tasting Rome. Check out Christina's work as well. Wonderful website and In the Kitchen With on Design Sponge. Always a favorite of ours. So many cool things going on. And I'll see you for lunch in Rome sometime soon.
Okay. Thank you. And you're always welcome.
Thank you. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. A big thanks to MoFad for sponsoring. Museum of Food and Drink is right down the street from our studio. And is a must check out. Music by Cookies, as always, and David Engineering. Thank you again.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.